You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I am Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas. And you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for July 2nd, episode 3985. Good morning, Horse World.
Welcome back to the show, Mary.
Yay, thanks for having me.
Yippee! The second Thursday of every month. No, the first Thursday. I have to fix that. Right here in my notes that I look at every single month, it says second. And it's not. It's the first Thursday of every month. Well,
and I was wondering if it was some sort of Mandela effect thing, because I remember it being on the second Thursday, and I don't remember it ever changing, but somehow it did.
It did. I think it was the second Thursday about 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. So just a short while ago.
Yes. This is a new change. We get together and we chit-chat about all things horse training and a little bit of people training here and there too. So if you haven't tuned in before, welcome to the show. And the first thing we do each and every episode is catch up a little bit on Mary's adventures, because she has plenty. And then we move on to phase two, which is answering listener questions. And if you want to submit a question as a listener to have Mary or one of other hosts answer, you need to be an HRN auditor. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/horseradionetwork. And it helps to support hosts on the show like Mary. So here we go. What have you been? You posted on your Facebook page that you had a particularly exciting and successful competition this past week. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, I took Remy and entered him in there's a show put on by the International Ranch Horse Association. It's called the Triple Crown Challenge, and it is held at the World Paint Show in Fort Worth in the Will Rogers Coliseum.
And ooh.
So, yeah, it was intense. It was intense, but we did pretty good.
No, it wasn't just pretty good. Drill down a little bit.
Yes. So I entered him in two classes in the ranch trail and ranch riding. Both are pattern classes. Both have a certain number of obstacles. Ranch trail obviously has a little bit more. And these were like, you know, $70,000 plus horses that we were up against, and some probably the most intense competition that I have ever done, that Remy has ever done. Of course, we were the only Mustang. And in the ranch trail, he did make it back to the finals. So he got to go in for the awards ceremony, and we got a medal.
Woo!
And yeah, I think we ended up 13th overall. So lucky number 13. And so I'm very proud of my boy.
That's no small potatoes.
No. And in both classes, we got above average scores. So if you're not familiar with how some Western classes like reining are judged, you go in there with a score already given. Everyone starts with a 70, and a 70 is everything is perfectly acceptable. You did nothing above average, no penalties, nothing terrible. So you start with a 70, and depending on how you do on each obstacle, they will give you plus or minus some points on every obstacle. So like if I go in and my trot isn't very good on the first, let's say the first element is an extended trot and it's not so good, the judge might say that's minus half a point. And you can go up to like 2 points, I think, in either direction. So the judge might say, oh, that's a terrible extended trot, it's minus 2 points. Or they might say, that's an excellent trot, plus 1.5 points. So depending on what you do, that changes whether your score goes above 70 or below 70. And then on top of that, if you get a penalty, let's say you didn't trot at all, you walked, they'll say minus 2 points and the penalties will really get you. So after that crash course, Remy on both of our classes had above average scores. We were like 71 and a half or somewhere around there on both of our classes. It's just the competition was that intense. So I'm really happy. And it showed that the judges liked him and gave him credit where it was due.
So for the judging, because I've not done any of these types of competitions. Matter of fact, I've never even attended one. Is it the overall performance that is judged for each, we're going to call it obstacle or movement? How much of that is the horse and how much of that is rider? For example, the extended trot. That was a pretty nice extended trot. I'm going to give them 0.5 plus. But the horse did it despite the rider. The rider's like, ah. How does that play into the scoring?
So without having the rule book in front of me, generally in Western competition, you want to have a horse that appears willingly guided. You'll see that a lot, especially in reining rule books. The horse is willingly guided. So maybe my horse his gait is very good, but it looks like the rider was maybe struggling to keep him in the trot, either maybe by pulling back the reins to prevent him from cantering or kicking the horse excessively to keep him from slowing down. So in that case, even though the horse itself was maintaining that extended trot, you're not going to get a very good score because it looks like the rider and the horse are fighting against each other. You're not
Got
in unison.
It.
The horse isn't willingly guided. So
Got
the more
it.
Visible your cues, the better. And it can go as severe as if you're jerking on your horse's face, you will get severe penalties, maybe even a DQ because you are being
Got
very
it.
Harsh with your horse.
Okay. So perhaps in the dressage world, harmony might be the equivalent. That the horse and the rider appear to be working together. But I like the way they phrase that, willingly guided. I think those are good words.
Yeah. So like, you know, if I show a normal cue, we're supposed to turn left, and you see that my hand moves to the left, I'm not going to get dinged for that. I am cueing my horse. That is perfectly acceptable. It's just if, let's say, I give the cue and the horse is like, nah, I'm going to go to the right. Well, now obviously.
That would be me. That's me and James.
And maybe you do keep him on pattern. Maybe you do prevent him from going to the right, but his head's all upside down, his tongue's hanging out of his mouth. He is guided. He did get guided onto the pattern, but not willingly. It was against his will. It was under duress.
Under duress.
That should be in the rule book.
That should be in the rule book. Anytime James wants to look at what the neighbor horses are doing, he is under duress because it's like, no, I need to look at them over there. I can't possibly take another step.
Yes.
I need to know. Who was it? Mrs. Kravitz that was on that. It was I Dream of Jeannie. Mrs. Kravitz was always peering through the curtains. He's Mrs.
Bewitched?
Kravitz. Bewitched. That's what it was.
Yeah. They were
it was Bewitched.
The same show.
It was basically the same show. Yeah.
Magic wife, lame husband who doesn't want wife to be magic.
Yes, that's the one.
Isn't that always the case with
me? It's always the case.
Putting us down.
Yeah, James is Mr. Kravitz because if he was a person, he would have the curtains peeked open and he'd be kind of hiding behind it 24/7. Oh
that
my gosh, that's funny.
That ties into my training tip.
Ding, 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 ding. And for those of you new to the Mary Kitzmiller training episode, this is where Mary gives us a little training tip to get things started, and she tells us the inspiration behind it. So go, Mary.
Oh, okay. So the training tip is titled, "The Horse Goes Where Your Eyes Go." So oftentimes when, let's say, I go into the arena at the show, and a banner is flapping in the breeze, or, you know, there's a cow, which there were cows in my trail class. There was a pen of cows that we had to ground tie next to. And of course, Remy freaking killed it because he's the ground tie master. But anyway, I digress. So your horse, you go into the pen and there's cows. There weren't supposed to be cows there. You didn't know there were going to be cows there. And your horse wants to look at the cows. What we tend to do as riders is we also look and hyper-focus on the cows.
Yes.
Because we've been through some stuff before with our spooky horse. And so we flash back. We have these like war flashbacks of what happened the last time we saw cows. And so our focus goes on the cows too. And then the horse is like, oh my gosh, my rider's really focused on the cows and I'm feeling them tense up. So this is a big deal. This is DEFCON 7 and I need to do something. So it's very easy to put your focus where the horse is putting their focus. I'm not saying ignore it completely because you do have to have your head on the swivel a little bit, but I am saying keep it in your peripheral and continue what you were doing. I'm going to the end of the arena. My eyes are going to look to the end of the arena no matter what my horse is doing. And more often than not, that does a great deal to help pull your horse out of his own brain and listen to you. There's a really, really great book came out many years ago. They made a movie about it. The movie's okay, but it's called The Art of Racing in the Rain. It's a very like, it's a beautiful book and it's got kind of some Zen philosophy mixed in there. It's about a dog whose owner is a race car driver. And the owner they talk about in the book how the owner has this special gift of being able to keep his car steady when there's been rain and the track is wet. And what happens to a lot of drivers, according to the book, is you're coming around the corner, the road's wet, it's very dangerous. A lot of drivers will look at the wall because they're afraid that they're going to go into the wall. Well, if you look at the wall, you're going to go into the wall. But you look to the next corner, a lot of times that car will magically right itself and come out of that dangerous situation. And it's the same for horses. And this applies to whether it's my horse is looking at something particularly spooky and I need their focus back on me, or I'm taking a line of jumps, or in my show this weekend, I was doing obstacles, loping over poles and stuff like that. I had to lope in between two hay bales that were just like 2 feet apart and come to a sliding stop and then back through them. And in every situation, as soon as I came out of one obstacle, my eyes went toward where's the next point that I've got to go to. And just that simple act of looking to the next thing, it helps steer my horse around and possibly tight corners without me having to really go heavy on my aids. Because when you look somewhere, your body is going to make thousands of micro adjustments. And your horse feels that. They feel a fly on their butt. They definitely feel when you change your body position and you change your focus. So, and it's the same. If I'm on a runaway horse or a horse that's bucking, I put my eyes on where I need to go, and it has kept me out of a lot of sketchy situations.
Yeah, and I think that's a real art form, is to train your body to not hyper-focus on the potentially scary thing, in our case, gopher tortoise crawling at 4.5 miles an hour across the street in front of you. Yet be aware of it, because you're right. It's a bad idea to literally put it out of your brain, because you do need to be aware of it, just like the horse needs to be aware of it. But just like your horse, you want the horse to be aware of it, but not hyper focused on it. One of the things that I started doing a long time ago, when someone pointed out to me very wisely that I tended to do that. I didn't think I did. Of course, I was in denial. It's like, no, you're hyper-focused on that scary thing. I thought I was looking away, but my brain was not looking away. My eyeballs were, brain wasn't. Is I would allow myself permission to see and focus on the thing, the tortoise. But then I had to switch it so that I looked at that tortoise and my brain focused on that tortoise and said, oh, what an adorable tortoise. I'll bet you he smells nice, like apples perhaps, so that my brain was making patterns that a horse could associate with pleasant and I could associate with pleasant so that I could reduce those micro adjustments that cause the tension that the horse very much reacts to. And I've found that it is very successful when I actually apply it. And in, the more I apply it and the more consistently I apply it, the better it gets and the better my horse gets. Lo and behold, and currently riding a really spooky, hyper-focused little Mr. Kravitz, I have had to retrain this skill because I got really lazy with Nigel. Nigel and I were pals. We kind of got things worked out. I didn't bother because he didn't bother either. But I kind of lost the skill. So, you know, if you're in that position where you're riding a horse that is more prone to hyper-focusing on inappropriate things and you're struggling with it when you didn't struggle with it on another horse or other horses, perhaps that skill set for your own body just needs a little tuning up.
Well, and you know, that that exact method is used in meditation practice.
No.
And yes, you've meditated before, surely.
I have not.
What?
I have, no.
Okay, you need to be doing that. I think every horse person needs to practice mindfulness and meditation. It will change your life. But so, you know, if you're someone like me or literally any horse person, we have a healthy dose of ADHD and caffeine addiction and anxiety.
Because... Stop there. I need to go refill my coffee. I'll be right back.
Okay. Yes, exactly.
Oh, my gosh. That's very interesting. Okay.
So when you're trying, when you first get into meditation, you think you're kind of told in a way, okay, sit there, don't think about anything. Well, what happens if you tell someone don't think about anything? You're going to think about all the things. And the more you're like in your brain, like, don't think, you'll think even harder about more things. It's called the monkey mind, and you have to train it. And our horses are dealing with this too. The horses can't see the forest for the trees and they get overwhelmed. And so instead of forcefully trying to cram the thoughts into a box and burn it, which is just not going to work, the thoughts are going to keep coming. You're going to sit there. And you're going to think, you know, okay, what am I going to have for lunch today? And I need to go to Walmart to pick up the cherry tomatoes for my pasta dish tonight. And you're like, dang it, I'm thinking again. So what you do, you can't stop the thought. The thought is going to come. You can't stop your fear and anxiety around the turtle most of the time or the fact that you need to focus on the turtle. But when you see a thought, think of it like a cloud floating by. You acknowledge it. You're like, oh, there's the thought, and I just happily send it away. There will be another thought that comes right after it, and you know, you're forgiving with yourself. You're not in trouble for thinking. You're just like, oh, there's another thought. Okay, I'm going to send you away. And over time, you do learn to get into this like really calm mindset. And I do meditation now, because I've converted to Catholicism, I pair it with prayer, but any kind of meditation or mindfulness thinking is amazing. I recommend everyone, it should be required for horse people.
Very interesting stuff. And I think, and again, this is something that I didn't really, growing up in the eventing universe, these are sorts of things we didn't do in the 80s. You just got on the horse and you ran.
You know? Yeah.
We weren't quite so subtle. But Kim Waldus kind of started me down this path of understanding the emotional and psychological aspect of riding, much to my benefit. I have hard eyes by nature, not just when I'm riding. Soften your eyes. But when I would soften my eyes, I would just completely zone out. I was not present. But what you just articulated makes what she was telling me 28 and a half years ago make sense, because I never quite understood what she meant by being present with soft eyes. Now it makes sense. The cloud description is perfect for me. It's my ding, ding, ding moment. Every single show we have one. I'm going to add that cloud description to my everyday routine because everybody should have that. So interesting. So maybe coming up on a show later on this year, we can find somebody who can talk about that aspect, the mindfulness, the meditation, even if they're not a equestrian person, of using those techniques to help us control the thoughts, good, bad, racing, obsessive.
I already all have those a things. Few people in mind, including including someone who very similar to what I went through for many years, developed severe fear and anxiety with horses. I mean, you hit the ground enough, it's going to come back and get you. trauma never goes away. Just because I hit the ground in my 20s and was fine and got up and rode the horse again, that comes back to bite you in the butt. When you're in your 30s, you put your foot in the stirrup and your brain's like, remember that time when you were 19?
Oh my gosh, yes.
A barbed wire fence and there was like blood everywhere. That could happen now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this person studied like Navy SEAL tactics to deal, because obviously they might have a little bit of anxiety in that job too, just a bit. And yeah, so I already have tons of ideas. Ooh,
watch this space, everybody.
Yes, but talking about focus, there are times when you want to focus on the micro and times when you want to focus on the macro. So, and in meditation, just completely zoning out, or sometimes people fall asleep during meditation. That's not mindfulness. You're just clocking out at that point. And so it's like you're aware of everything, but also focused on no one thing. It's very interesting and it's hard to get to, but it's worth the journey. But whenever people talk, if you talk to some Western riders who ride a lot of bucks, they talk about getting a faraway look in your eye. And if your horse might buck or is in a position to start bucking, instead of focusing on the ground, my saddle, the horse, what's going on right now, focus on the horizon. And so that's a way of like, you've still got to focus, but you've changed the lens of your camera. And it gives you, I don't know, like this proprioception, however you say that word, and this way to kind of stay in the situation without being so intensely drawn into it that you're in trouble. I don't know. It's a whole thing. It's a bunch of woo-woo stuff, but it works.
There we go. Watch this space for more on the inner mind of equestrianism. We'll do that. So before we move on to our first listener question, we're going to hear from our title sponsor, Farnam, who makes a brand new product called Endure Gold Fly and Mosquito Control. Really big name for a very interesting product. This episode is brought to you by Farnam and Endure Gold Killer Fly and Mosquito Control, a new fly spray for horses. Discover fly protection redefined with Endure Gold, made to annihilate flies, ticks, and mosquitoes with brand new EPA-approved ingredients never before seen in equine care. Endure Gold is backed by science and built for hard work, delivering fast knockdown and up to 14 days of fly protection. Add Endure Gold to your arsenal and upgrade your fly control rotation. We didn't get around to posting questions for this month on the auditor's Facebook page because Mary was a little bit busy at a horse show, so forgive us. We just dug out a couple of them that we were pretty sure we didn't answer from previous episodes and perhaps take a wider view of them. This is going to be the wider 30,000 foot view show today. So someone had written by a little while back about how to prepare for getting back on a horse that did something scary the last time they were ridden. And perhaps we can look at this from the horse's point of view, things you can do with the horse, but also the point of view of the human, considering the discussion we were having early in the show. So what are some of the processes you might go through with a horse that perhaps the last time you got on them, they had a little bucking fit or they reared up or threw themselves on the ground and tossed their toys out of the pram?
So this is definitely one of those "it depends" questions. You ask some of the old timers, like, what do I do if my horse won't get on the trailer? And they're like, well, it depends. But I am going to give you some answers. So there are some questions that I would ask, like if someone was telling me of this situation and they're like, what do I do next time? I'm going to ask some questions to get to the culprit of what's going on. And you can ask yourself these questions. So your horse did something scary last time they were ridden. First, I would ask, okay, is this something that I was expecting or prepared for, or, you know, expecting the possibility that this could happen? Maybe it was ride number one on a colt. So even though I don't want a horse to buck during the first ride, I understand that that may happen. It's not terribly out of the realm of possibility. And it may be something where I did everything that I thought I could do and the horse was showing me all the good signs and they bucked and now, you know, we got through it. Now I'm tying for ride number two. If it's something that, you know, we got through and I knew what caused it, I might be able to just keep going like I was going, but with a, you know, I will have a plan. Okay, the horse last time tried to buck from the trot to the canter. So this time I'm going to do A, B, or C to help keep me safe. And that might be as I go into the canter, I have my hand halfway slid down the rein. So as soon as I feel any tenseness, I can put that horse into a one rein stop. Or perhaps I can get a partner to come into the round pen and they make the horse canter and I can just focus on staying on and being a comfort to the horse. So in those cases where this was a reasonable thing that could have happened and I did all my prep work, you can pretty much stay on course. Let's say this was a horse that's never bucked in their life and they are 10 years old and have always ridden really well and they bucked me off for some reason. Well, then I need to play detective. You know, maybe I changed saddles. Maybe the saddle didn't fit correctly. Maybe my horse is in pain. In the case of geldings, sometimes they need their sheath cleaned. Because when they get like, you know, a bean up in there, and it can be very painful for them to go into a canter when they are in need of cleaning. So things like that, I'm going to have to play detective and see, was there something physical that caused it? Let's say it's a horse that bucked pretty hard. I totally didn't expect it to happen. It happened. And I don't even know why it happened. I have no idea why. In that case, I may need to say, okay, let's do a restart. I missed something along the way here because it was fine until it wasn't. It was a wreck. We did not end the ride well. So in that case, I need to wipe the slate clean and say, okay, let's go back to the beginning and let's retrace our steps and see if we can find what happened. So I guess the answer for all of these scenarios is you need to ask, okay, what happened? Why did it happen? I need to figure out why it happened. Can I stay on the same track and ride through it? Or do I need to go back? And even a horse, I've had horses come in for training before, and this happens more often than not. The owner says, oh, he's really great. We take him on trails every summer and blah, 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 blah. And then I saddle the horse for the first time and he bucks like crazy with the saddle. So for my own peace of mind, I don't care what the history on this horse is so much. I'm going to say, okay, let's pretend you're a brand new baby and I'm going to start you over like you've never had any of this done. And I'm going to take about a week and work through all my groundwork again and go through all my steps and see where I might find the problem. And oftentimes I can see, oh, I figured it out. This horse has never had a back cinch and my saddle has a back cinch. Or, oh, this horse has never been properly prepared for scary things like maybe a flag or, you know, desensitization techniques. But I can't tell. I have to play forensic detective and go back through and check everything out. Let's say I do all that and either I just don't have the confidence to work through it or I plumb don't know what the heck is going on. That's when you need to call in professional help. Another pair of eyes to not only look at the horse and say, oh, well, that's your problem right there, but I would have no problem. And I've done this as a professional trainer myself. I will pay someone else that I think has a better chance of figuring out what's going on to put some rides on that horse. And it's for the sake of my own confidence and it's for my horse's sake. Sometimes I know exactly what's going on and I know that I'm not going to ride that. It's not for me. So I will go to help myself.
Yeah, I think that's very hard for many of us who don't ride or train professionally anymore or ever, but still feel like they have a very good knowledge base. It can be a little tough to swallow your pride and put yourself out there because you're opening yourself up to criticism when you do that. You've got this horse started. He's a 5-year-old, he's a 6-year-old, and he's doing all these things, but now things are going bad. And you go to another professional, you're opening yourself up to that other professional going, you just kind of messed this up royally. That can be tough. Now, and sometimes the answer is no, you didn't mess it up royally. You just took a wrong turn at 43rd Street. But that can be hard. So for a situation where we're going to take this a step further, things didn't go well on the last ride. Things were scary for you, but not necessarily for the horse. For example, you were riding in an arena situation and things were going well and you did some new work and the horse got a little amped up, got a little sideways, and then got bulky at the end of the ride and just refused to move anywhere at all, which is something that does happen when you start working on more advanced movements. The horse can just completely shut down and not move forward at all, which was scary for you because, oh my gosh, he's going to rear any second. But the rear never happened. And this might feed back into our conversation at the beginning of the show. Your brain went to, oh my gosh, my horse was going to rear by the end of the ride, even though he didn't. So now you get on again, and now you're afraid you're going to make your horse rear.
Yeah, it's really hard not to dial in on that. And it kind of ties into everything we've been talking about. You've got to figure out a way to pull your focus off of what might go wrong and be in the moment and say, you know, okay, I'm going to do step one, step two, step three. If the fear overpowers you, I don't have a problem stepping off. I don't have a problem going to professional help, letting someone else ride it out and show me that it's really okay. Or no, there really was a serious problem and I did need the professional help to get it worked through. It really pays to have a professional in your corner that you have access to, that you can help through those things. And if you have the access to something like, you know, maybe I need to just ride a calmer, older, broker horse for a little while to get my confidence back. Or maybe I need to have the hard conversation with myself. Is this horse for me? Am I overhorsed right now? Because, you know, we're doing this for our enjoyment. And if you're deathly afraid every time you get in the saddle, there's no point in that. You know, you might need to reevaluate whether this is your horse.
There you go. That's a tough one, but you're right. I think there would be a lot of train wrecks avoided if we had that conversation earlier on. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I love Remy is, you know, at that show this weekend, I went there knowing that we were not going to win. The only way we would have won that class is if everyone fell off but I love horses like Remy because I know what he is. He's the same horse every day. I can pull him off the pasture after 6 months of doing nothing and he will be the same. He's trustworthy. He's dependable. He's honest. Does he drive like a Ferrari? No, but do I know how to drive a Ferrari? Also, no.
It's a good point.
Do I want to deal with a temperamental, you know, race car that's got 57 gears and if you don't drive it right, you crash into a wall? No. you know, I can, I'm a professional, but there's something to be said about the horse that's like, you know, are we the flashiest? No, but that horse will ride through fire. And as long as there's cookies on the other side. And
there you go.
He's like a very dependable Toyota, which is just a nice car to have. He's got good gas mileage. He's a sensible decision to drive.
But is he a Corolla or a Civic?
Isn't Civic Honda?
Oh, sorry, Honda. Sorry. I'll just cut that out.
I can't believe you don't know your cars.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's just a good point A to point B car. Nothing too fancy, but he's mine and I love him to death.
There you go. He's yours and you love him to death. Speaking of love him to death, we love our sponsors and we're going to hear from another one right now. And then we're going to be back with another question.
Easy, effective, and eco-friendly fly control starts with Fly Predators. Fly predators are the organic, natural way to dramatically minimize your fly problem. Learn more about fly predators and other Spalding Labs fly control solutions at Spalding, Spalding-labs.com.
So, next question coming up. We dug this one out of the archives. I think this is 2018. This is a really old one. What do you look for when you think a horse is ready to move up from a snaffle or curb bit, which we answered on the show? But we thought we'd take a larger view and talk a little bit about the progression of headgear on your horse and what does it look like? So run with it.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about what the traditional Western style of riding, some people call it like the vaquero style or the California style. This derives from the West Coast, and it's comes from some of the techniques comes all the way back from Europe and the old Spanish school, and then we've got influence from Mexico and California, and it's this very thoughtful and progressive and slow way to develop your horse over time. And it's a style that you'll see often at these events that I show in, the stock horse, the ranch horse, cow horse style of riding. And if you were to go to the pen this weekend and see the horses in the warm-up pen, you would have seen all sorts of different headgears on each horse. So we had some horses riding in a snaffle bit with split reins, very common. We had some horses riding in a hackamore, and I don't mean mechanical hackamore. I mean a rawhide bozal or noseband and horsehair Makati reins, which is very traditional. It's a hand-braided piece of equipment. And then some folks were riding in a small hackamore, very like a mini hackamore, very thin noseband. And over that, they had a full bridle with a spade bit. So kind of not very unsimilar to like a double bridle in the dressage world. You've got a piece of equipment that's more for direct communication and a piece of equipment that is starting to introduce leverage. And then finally, you have the horse that is what we consider straight up in the bridle, which is usually a spade bit or a curb bit and Rommel reins, or they could be split leather reins. So typically we progress the horse through all of these steps by age. And when you first, I know when I was studying this more traditional way of doing things, one of my questions was, well, how do I know when I'm supposed to move on? Or do I need to move on? At this particular event, they did not have an age rule for horses. So I could have showed Remy in the hackamore, the snaffle, if I wanted to, despite him being 11 years old, which I think is really cool. So maybe you don't want to move on. You can do everything you need to in a snaffle. You can even neck rein in a snaffle. You don't need a magic bit to neck rein your horse. I neck rein with a neck rope and no bridle. So it's more about signal at that point. But if I am wanting to progress my horse and move him onto the bridle, how do I know that he's ready? So I want to make sure I have decent control of all of his body parts with my snaffle or hackamore. So can I easily move his hips and his shoulders? And can I put his rib cage where I need to? Can I stop him from going forward? Can I bring him backwards? Can I bring him into collection? So that's one check thing off the checklist. And even though I'm riding a horse in a snaffle, maybe it's a two-year-old, maybe it's a, I don't really ride two-year-olds so much anymore, but maybe it's a three-year-old. And I'm progressing toward one day riding that horse in the bridle one-handed. Even though maybe I won't do it this month or the next month, I am going to start doing those things in the snaffle before I need to move to the bridle. So that'll involve pitching my horse away and saying, hey, can I just lay this rein across? And you respond to it. And if they don't, then I'll pick up two hands and fix the horse, put them where I need to, release once they do it, and then I'll try it again. So I pretty much get my horse riding around one-handed before I even go to a curb bit. There's no sense in just not ever doing it and then putting them in a curb bit one day and saying, oh, you now have to learn one-handed riding also while getting used to this new bit. So I always test my horses out. You know, can I do this with the lightest cue possible, with just laying my rein across the neck without taking the drape out of the reins? Once I can do that, I'm pretty sure the transition to a curb is going to be palatable for that horse. Now, in like the more Texas middle of the country style of Western, you would just go straight from the snaffle to a bridle. And there's not really anything else to it. But if we're going back to that California way, they have that really neat transition. A lot of people will start in a snaffle and then move to the hackamore and get everything done you need to in the hackamore. And then they will have their horse wear the bridle over that smaller hackamore, but they're still doing all the work in the hackamore. But now you get teaching your horse to just wear that new bit. And there's no pressure. They just wear it and they learn to carry it in their mouth. Cause that's part of learning to ride in a bridle. So the horse needs to learn how to carry that bit without any interference for the rider. And that keeps the horse from being uncomfortable and gaping their mouth and putting their tongue over the bit. And you'll still ride with the Makati reins on that hackamore. But then every so often you can come in and pick up your set of reins that is hooked to the bridle. So let's say I need to go out and work my horse on the ranch and I need to go work cattle or something. I'm going to probably do more of my work in the hackamore. But then maybe on the way home, when I go through the gate at the end of the day, I'll say, let's see if we can get this very simple maneuver, low energy maneuver done in the bridle. And you'll do that for some time until you're actually then doing most of your work in the bridle. But if the horse needs help, you can go back to the hackamore. And once you're at that point, then you can put your horse straight up in the bridle. So everything is about making the transition as easy as possible. So even if you don't know the exact right amount of steps to do, just think about, okay, how can I make this palatable for my horse, easy to understand? How can I make the transition to the next thing as smooth as possible?
There we go. So they overlap each other. It's not a case of you move out of this one and into the next one. They literally overlap each other.
Yes. And in a case where you're not riding, they call that the two rein, where you have the bridle and the hackamore. Let's say you're not doing that. A lot of reiners don't do that. They'll just go straight from snaffle to bridle. So sometimes you're like, this horse is ready for the bridle, and you're riding him around and you're like, yeah, he's doing pretty good, but I think I need to go back in there and soften him up. I'll ride for a few weeks in the snaffle again and fix whatever I need to. I'm not static in, oh, I switched bits and now this is the bit we have to do for life. Even a very broke horse like Remy, I could feel he has some stiffness in his left shoulder this weekend, and I need to really get on that left side and get it supple again. Well, it's easier for me to do that in the hackamore or the snaffle because I have that direct guide to his face. And so I'll ride him for a week or two in the snaffle, or I might ride him for the winter in the hackamore. And then as we get back into spring again, okay, let's go back to the bridle. There's no rules outside of the show pen on what you have to do.
So for the types of competitions that you do with Remy, are there strict guidelines as to what headgear is allowed and what isn't, or is it pretty open?
It's open within reason. So, you know, there are guidelines, for instance, with the bridle, there's certain mouthpieces that are not going to be allowed. Obviously, I can't ride in a bicycle chain bit, which I'm sad to say those do exist. So certain mouthpieces are legal or illegal. There's certain measurements to the spade bit that it needs to adhere to. As far as like, if it's a bridle, it must have, and by bridle, I mean, it's a bit with shanks on. It's a curb bit. It must have some sort of curb strap or curb chain, because without that, it will not properly be balanced in the horse's mouth. It'll be very uncomfortable, but you can't have that too tight. It needs to be a certain width. You need to be able to fit a certain amount of fingers between the horse's chin and the chain. You know, all this is all for being humane with the horse. So yeah, there's going to be several different rules and guidelines, but then you have wiggle room within that to say, well, my horse tends to like this kind of mouthpiece better. My horse tends to like, you know, a leather curb as opposed to a chain curb. So, but yeah, there's a lot of rules there that it, and it's mostly for the horse's sake, for being humane.
So that people don't put combinations together that are just plain inappropriate regardless.
Yeah.
Very interesting stuff. So is it common? Now, again, this is just someone from outside your universe asking silly questions. The side pull, the ubiquitous side pull, which has become popular in lots and lots of disciplines. It's not just something that you see in Western places anymore. Is that piece of equipment that is only used in training, or are there places where horses compete in side pulls?
So for the associations I show in, you can't use a side pull. It's totally acceptable for training, especially in colt starting. I am sure maybe like in Western dressage or something like that, I'm sure there are competitions where that's acceptable. I'm not sure why it wouldn't be allowed. There's no, but it's typically you either need a snaffle bit, a traditional hackamore, or some sort of bridle.
So if the horse is trotting around with nothing in his mouth, he's going to have a bosal, because I pronounce it Basel, but I'm pretty sure that's not the way you're supposed to say it. He would have a bosal of some type on.
Yes. And there's rules on what kind of bosal, because they have made these things that have a steel core to it, which is not acceptable. In fact, for this show, before I was able to walk into the show pen, they had a judge stationed in the warm-up pen, and I had to go up to him and drop my bridle and show him all my equipment. And he had to give me the go-ahead, like, yep, this is okay to use.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yes. So a traditional hackamore will have a soft rawhide core, so it's flexible. It's not something that's rigid or hard, and it's got to be a certain diameter, you know. So there's rules about that, but in general, yeah, if you are riding with no bit, it's going to be in that traditional hackamore.
Very interesting stuff. Well, speaking of interesting, again, interesting commercial from one of our important sponsors. We will be right back with our third and final question of the day.
Woohoo! You can enjoy your favorite equine videos all in one place with Ride TV, the ultimate equine streaming platform. The newly relaunched Ride TV has all the series you love, like Rockstar Vets and Mini Horses, plus top-tier training videos and event footage from BarrelRacing.com and Horse and Rider On Demand. Whether you're ready to relax with your favorite series, binge watch competition footage, or train with a world champion, subscribe to Ride TV today for only $19.99 to see where your ride takes you. Visit ridetvgo.tv to subscribe.
So our third and final question of the show, but worry not, we're going to have a post show for you auditors. The question from many years ago, someone is asking about their horse when they were doing canter work in the arena would get all amped up. Once they were cantering, they were fine, but doing the transitions caused a lot of amping up. So I thought we'd have a little chat about dealing with horses and riders, because obviously if the horse gets amped up asking for a canter has something to do with the rider because the rider's doing the asking. Horses who get either too sharp or too dull off the aids and ways that we can help work through that to get some middle ground. You can either start with too dull or too sharp. It's your call.
Okay. Well, I'll just start with the concept of transitions themselves.
And ooh, look at you. Yeah,
I know, right? So everyone needs to do more transitions. Transitions are where things happen or don't happen. If I have a horse that likes to run off in the canter.
And hey, you're too far from your microphone, okay, sorry, Mary. Stop petting the kitten.
Well, I was throwing her off the table because she was actually knocking my microphone over.
So the weird noises were the cat getting on the microphone, and then the fact that Mary was disappearing off of her sound completely was her getting the cat off. And we're leaving this in the show, people.
I was lightly yeeting the cat from the table. And she will come back, but yeah, she's a nuisance, that one. Anywho, so we all need to do more transitions. If I have a horse that runs off in the canter, instead of just cantering them and trying to hold them back, I'm going to do 4 bajillion trot to canter transitions. Trot, canter, trot, canter, trot, canter, trot, canter, over and over and over again. So that gives the horse the comfort of knowing we don't have to stay in the canter, and it's going to get the horse to start using his brain. Like, man, every time I pick up the canter, we go right back to trot again. And over time, it helps build their confidence with going into the canter. It helps build my confidence with going into the canter, because sometimes if I have a runaway, I'm like, which I haven't dealt with in many, many, many years, but if I have a horse that I'm worried might bolt, I get really scared and I don't want to canter ever, which doesn't solve the problem. But if I can do a transition and canter for one stride and then put them right back to trot, it makes me feel better and safer. So there's no point in staying in the gate if it's the transition that is causing trouble. And every horse is going to go through periods where they are too dull to a transition or too sharp. That's pretty normal. It's a balance you have to keep. Remy, for instance, tends to be too lazy in his transitions. So a horse like that, I'm going to, one, make sure that I'm not overdoing my cues. I'm not harping on them with my legs. I'm not hanging on the bit. I'm going to ask very gently, please go into the canter. And if they don't, I'm going to hurry them into the canter, like, you better go right now. And I don't, at that point, if it's a horse that's gotten particularly dull and lazy, I don't care about if they're collected or on the bit or anything. I just work on that gas pedal and say, get to canter right now. As soon as they get there, I let them come back and slow down. If it's a very lazy horse, I will actually let them come to a complete stop. I'm like, that's all I ask. I just wanted a little bit of tiny try. And if you try for me, I'm going to give you a break. And for a lazy horse, that is their bread and butter. They're like, oh, I just have to try a little bit and you'll leave me alone for a second. I love it. So I'll work on that gas pedal and make sure I can put my foot down and that horse can go. Once I have that working again, now I can go back into my canter work and play with the, you know, with the collection and everything like that. But the important thing is to release them into that upward transition, because if I'm trying to get my horse to canter and they finally do it beautifully, and then I just keep my leg on him and make him canter around, why would he want to try for me again? Because he tried and then I gave him nothing. I just said, okay, now work harder. I've got to build his mental capacity to stay in that canter. And I do that by doing lots of transitions. Now, let's say I've gotten after my horse and said, you know, you need to canter right now. And the next week he comes out and he's a little jittery and I barely lay my leg on him and he's like, I have to canter. Okay, well, now I need to do things a little differently. I need to, if I have a horse that's extremely nervous about canter, I am not going to kick or chase that horse into the canter. I am going to start by, can I just ask you using my seat? And I'm going to progress through my cues very slowly and fluidly and calmly. And let's say I've got a real nervous horse that likes to bolt into that canter. And one of these times I asked him to canter, it takes him 3 strides to get into that canter. I'm going to be like, that's great. I love that you took your time. You are allowed to take your time because you're nervous. So, you know, sometimes if I have a really nervous horse, I'll let them take half the arena to get to canter. Why? Because I know that if I need to get this horse into the canter lickety split, that is not a problem. I just have to sneeze and that horse is probably going to canter. So I'm going to ask them so softly that if they take their time and they kind of build into that walk and maybe even trot a little bit and then canter, be like, that's perfect. That's exactly what I wanted. And as soon as they get to canter, I'm going to slowly bring them back into trot and maybe all the way back to a walk. So it's almost the same problem solving thing I'm doing in both instances. I'm going to let him come back to a walk and I'm going to say, you did beautifully. So I'm going to change the type of person I am with each horse. If they're being lazy and belligerent and they're like that teenage kid that doesn't want to get out of bed in the morning, I'm going to be like, up and at him, let's go. You know, the day's a wasting. You better go right now. If it's the very nervous and frightful horse, I'm going to gentle parent them and I'm going to be very soft. I'm going to say, it's okay. You know, you can do this. Take your time. Think your way through it. And my goal is to get the horse somewhere in the middle. But I'm often going to be changing my approach with the same horse because some weeks they'll get too fast. Some weeks they'll get too slow.
That is very good that plays into ride the horse you're on in the minute, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we tend to generalize. Well, my horse is, insert word, when if we spent more of our ride thinking about the exact horse I have here. And another thing, I think we talked about this a little bit last month, is rather than my horse gets amped up in my canter transition, put a little bit of time into I am creating the amped up horse into the transition. What am I doing? And you talked about being the different person. If you have a horse that's getting amped up, be the calmest, quietest, most subtle human being on the planet during your ride so that you're not inadvertently creating that anxiety because you're anticipating it.
Yeah, you've got to be the voice of reason, which sucks, but that's the way it is. And you know, it's like you're that horse's parent in a sense. And, you know, sometimes there are situations that kids get into where even though this is a scary thing, we need to remain calm. We have to be the strong one. And sometimes it's going against every natural instinct in my body because I want to panic too. But if I panic, who's going to be driving the car? So, yeah, I have to be the voice of reason and I have to change my style depending on the horse. I have to be what that horse needs in that moment.
Dun, dun, dun. And if somebody out there in the universe wants to have you help them with their horse, have you come out and do a clinic, maybe check into your artwork. Where can they find you online?
You can connect with me on Facebook through my personal page, Mary K. Kitzmiller, or my business page, Mary Kitzmiller Horsemanship. And I also have contact information on my website, marykitzmiller.com.
Dun, dun, dun. Glenn and Jamie will be back again tomorrow with more fun and hijinks. Auditors, right. Stay tuned.